It's Legal Roundtable Day, and there's a flurry of issues related to law on the national level and closer to home. They range from travel bans to modifying Missouri's discrimination law. Joining us in studio are regulars, attorney Mark Smith, associate vice chancellor at Washington University, where he also directs the Career Center. Bill Freivogel is professor of journalism at Southern Illinois University in Carbondale. Professor Sydney Watson is with the St. Louis University Health Law Policy Center. She's been our go-to person on health care for the past several years, and we wanted to get her take on the current debate on repealing and replacing the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare. But first, there are some things going on as we speak that we do want to mention. Nomination or the confirmation hearing for Supreme Court Justice nominee Neil Gorsuch is taking place today. And James Comey, the director of the FBI, is also testifying today on Capitol Hill. Bill Freivogel, I know that you have been tracking this all morning. Any news been made yet?
Well, yes. FBI Director Comey made news right away. He said that, at least early in the hearing this morning, he said in answer to questions that the FBI was conducting a counterintelligence investigation into Russian interference with the 2016 presidential election, and that included looking at any connections to the Trump campaign. He said there was no information to back up the tweets that President Trump has made regarding President Obama supposedly having wiretapped Trump Tower. So those were the two big headlines out of that hearing so far.
There was also testimony, wasn't there, that just denying that the Brits had any kind of involvement in working for Obama in that surveillance.
Yes, correct. Director of Intelligence, National Intelligence, Rogers said that there was no interference by that the British had not engaged in any kind of wiretapping of Trump Tower, and agreed with the British intelligence agency's categorization of that as nonsense.
Anything out of the Gorsuch hearing?
Well, you know, these Supreme Court, not a whole lot. The confirmation hearings, it takes a while for them to get cranked up. First the members each take 10 minutes or whatever, a number of minutes to say what they're thinking about in connection with this confirmation, and so they start off on a very boring, note. So I don't believe we'll get to Gorsuch's statement probably for a few more minutes or hours.
Yeah, probably not questioning until tomorrow. Right?
I'm probably not questioning.
It's a 4-day hearing, if I understand.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Okay. Well, there will be plenty of news made this week. Is it fair to say this is a bad day for President Trump?
Well, it's a bad day on the investigation front. I mean, he had just tweeted that the whole investigation of the Russian involvement in the presidential election was fake news. So it would seem as though Comey's statement would be a direct contradiction of that.
Don't you think the Gorsuch stuff is going well for him? I mean, I don't think there's any problems there.
I mean, I think Gorsuch will eventually be confirmed. I think the Democrats probably should confirm him. I think he'll be a very conservative justice,
right.
Who will surprise people on some issues. I think one of the interesting things that came out over the weekend were some of the memos that showed his involvement in some of the Bush administration's, George W. Bush administration's, torture, enhanced interrogation issues. He took the position that the president has almost unlimited power there, and that the courts really can't second guess him on issues of like whether Guantanamo prisoners should be able to get access to the courts. So those are sort of issues that are relevant to the immigration order, where that same kind of subject comes up. So I think those will be something that he's asked about, and there'll be a lot of other issues, of course.
Sydney Watson, let me turn to you. Later this week, I believe it's on Thursday, that the House is going to vote on the tweaking of the Affordable Care Act. What do you make of this whole process? You've been following this since since day one. What do you make of where we are right now?
Well, I think some of the big news right now is we have numbers from the Congressional Budget Office that tell us that this is neither a replacement bill or a repeal bill. And what it's going to do if it passes is leave 14 million people without insurance in the first year, 24 million people uninsured over 10 years. And 10 years out, we will see 42 million Americans without health insurance. That's about double the number who would have been uninsured if we had done nothing with the Affordable Care Act.
You've seen some of the tweaks that that Speaker Ryan has been talking about. What are they, and how would they differ what's going on right now?
Well, what's been proposed by the leadership are changes to the premium tax credits that now vary by income and by premium costs to turn them into a flat tax. The other major change are cuts and caps to Medicaid funding that would leave about 14 million low-income people uninsured. The tweaks that are being talked about would actually leave more people uninsured. They're talking about ending the Medicaid expansion sooner. Rather than phasing it out in 2020, phasing it out sooner, which simply means more people uninsured sooner.
How would can we tell how we in Missouri and Illinois would be affected?
Over in Illinois, where they have expanded Medicaid, they will lose that expansion. The phase out of the expansion requires states to pay 2.5 to 5 times more than it costs them now to cover working adults in the Medicaid expansion. Estimates are that that means states will drop the expansion, so thousands and thousands of people uninsured there. Here in Missouri, this capping of Medicaid means nationwide about 17% cut. Here, we don't really have many working adults on Medicaid. We have a program that covers seniors, children, people with disabilities, very, very low-income parents who earn less than 17% of poverty. That's who's going to be cut here. And we're talking thousands of people at risk of losing their coverage, at risk of seeing service reductions, covered services, prescription drugs, mental health services may be cut, and also cuts in provider payments. We have some of the lowest provider reimbursement rates in the country already. We have, if we see those cut even further, we're going to have a program where people may have a Medicaid card but won't have real access to care.
Those people who are forced, if I can use that word, to leave the plan, do they have any legal recourse?
Not if it's a change in the law at the congressional level.
Mm-hmm. Just as simple as that. Not that this is simple, but just
yeah, but not as individuals. I would not rule out litigation over some of the changes to Medicaid, but we'll have to see what is passed by Congress and what happens. And I think there's some hope that this plan won't get through. Yeah. We see concern both within the Republican Party on the far right and also from moderate Republicans. Mm-hmm. This is a controversial plan, and it should be controversial.
The numbers I've seen, maybe as many as 40 Republicans in the House might vote against it.
Both sides, from the moderate
sides.
And
yes.
The conservative.
Yeah,
and,
right.
And I think the likelihood of a lawsuit would be, I agree with you, nothing's going to, there won't be, or it would be tough to win if Congress changes it. But if Tom Price starts trying to do things on his own, then there might be, more questions. Is he working outside his authority as, head of the Department of Health and Human Services? Right. Would he be able to do that?
Yes, and we also saw two letters last week from Tom Price encouraging states to experiment more, both in Medicaid and encouraging them to try to come up with alternatives in the private insurance market. So there's some options on that front, mm-hmm. too.
A lot of people are conceding that there are certain things that need to be fixed. What needs to be fixed?
Oh, I think certainly with the Affordable Care Act, we've been very worried that for people in that moderate income range, that premiums are still too high, particularly for older Americans, and that deductible and copays are too high. And that's something that really needs to be fixed. The problem is the leadership proposal really rolls back and makes both premiums and out-of-pockets much higher for older Americans. I talked to Susan, a lady from Baldwin, last week. She's 64 years old, and right now she has a marketplace plan that costs her $161 a month. Under the leadership proposal, her premiums will jump to $869 a month, almost $900 a month. That's really unaffordable, particularly given that Susan earns about $20,000 a year. She also would see her deductible jump from $500 a year to $3,000 a year. So the people who are going to really be hurt by this proposal are older, poorer Americans.
And to a very large degree, the people who voted for Donald Trump as president.
That's what the polls are telling us.
Any thoughts on this bill before we move on?
No.
Okay. Let's talk about the immigration ban. Our time is going to be a little bit limited today, and I want to get to some of the issues that affect us more directly here in Missouri. But once again, the president is having difficulty with the courts with regard to his latest immigration ban. Bill, I'll turn to you. Is this something that has to go to the Supreme Court?
Well, it may end up there to get resolved. I think the big sort of legal issue is, to what extent can judges look at statements that President Trump made during the campaign and that he and his advisors made during the campaign and afterwards to try to figure out what is the motive, what is the purpose of the travel ban, and whether or not it is it's a travel ban that's aimed at a particular religion, at Muslims, and in which case the judges in Honolulu, for example, found that that would be that kind of a travel ban would be a violation of the Establishment Clause. It would disfavor a religion, and under the First Amendment, the government cannot do that.
It keeps coming back to comments made by people like Rudy Giuliani and others months ago that this was a ban on Muslims.
Yeah, well, the president started out. Donald Trump began with that premise back in the campaign, and then Giuliani, I guess, said that the president called him up and said, give me a Muslim ban that'll be legal, and that was the first attempt at the executive order. Which had some preferences for Christians, so that was even within the text of that order, there was favoring of one religion and disfavoring of another. Now the revised travel ban doesn't have that language, but it still is directed at people from Muslim countries, and so the judge thought that all of that. That in First Amendment Establishment Clause cases, that you look at the statements, the real purpose of of the public official in taking the action. So that looking at that real purpose, the purpose was to harm a particular religion. Now, the other people on the other side of that is you should just confine yourself to the four corners of the executive order. It doesn't have any words in there that are clearly discriminatory, and the president has a lot of power when it comes to both immigration and national security.
Any other thoughts, Mark?
So this is different. The previous rulings on the first ban were based on procedure, due process, concerns that individuals, they had due process rights and they were being violated. So that's not the argument now. And the court specifically said, we're not getting to the religious discrimination issue. Now they're getting to the religious discrimination issue. I think, not agreeing or disagreeing, but just as trying to be neutral and handicapping it, I think this decision is probably more subject to being overturned than the previous ones. That'd be my read.
Well, that was the idea.
These court decisions, I think, I'm less confident they'll be upheld on appeal than the other ones. I thought the other ones were pretty solid. I think this has got an argument, but when you start bringing in statements that a candidate made, I think that's a slippery slope we could be going down.
Thoughts, Sydney?
Well, I'm just reminded that President Obama made some promises about the Affordable Care Act that also came back to haunt him in some litigation. So I think maybe the legal issue to track here is that candidates and presidents need to be careful about what they say to the public. It may come back to haunt them in the courts.
Months afterwards.
And some of these statements that President Trump has made were as President Trump.
Oh, that's true. Where
he was talking about trying to favor Christian refugees. And just last week where he was attacking this most recent court decision and said, well, this our new executive order was just trying to accomplish the same thing as the first executive order. That first one was even better. So he doesn't help himself with continuing to do that.
Not only with a lot of people, but certainly with the judges.
Yes.
That has been pointed out prior. We have to take a break. We'll do that now. We'll come back. Continuing our legal roundtable panel discussion, with me in studio are Mark Smith, Sidney Watson, and Bill Freivogel. We'll be back in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back as we continue our legal roundtable panel discussion with Professor Sidney Watson of St. Louis University, Bill Freivogel of Southern Illinois University at Carbondale, and Mark Smith of Washington University. Here in Missouri, the President Pro Tem of the Senate wants to dump the nonpartisan court plan that is really served, as we've discussed before, as a national model. He's not happy that three finalists who have been selected through that plan are not conservative enough. Is there any way that Governor Greitens could not choose one of these three on that basis or any other basis?
I don't know.
Yeah, I think we talked about this before. I think he could and then send it back and they'd go, but they could, nominate the same ones. But he's supposed to pick one of these, and I don't know of anyone not picking one of the three in the past, previous governors doing that.
I think on the overall issue of getting rid of what's called the Missouri Plan, it's called the Missouri Plan because it was a model for the country on how to get away from electing appellate court judges. The idea of getting rid of the Missouri Plan is a terrible idea. We see only has to look across the river to Illinois, where we see large sums of money being thrown into judicial elections for the Supreme Court to try to affect decisions, to see how bad that kind of approach is. So I'm not too sympathetic to the getting rid of the Missouri Plan. I mean, and if you listen to the Republican appointed members of the Supreme Court, both current and former, they also think it's a terrible idea to get rid of the Missouri Plan.
Sidney, bringing politics into this process is problematical.
Of course it is, and it's called the Missouri Plan because it is a model for the country. It's been a model of taking politics and money and partisanship out of the selection of judges. We have a well-functioning court. We have a court with good judges across the political spectrum, and the idea of throwing this into politics is very discouraging for the judicial system. It's the proposal seems to want to make judges more like the legislature, more like the elections that we use for the governors. And what we really need is a judicial branch that's independent. And the Missouri Plan gives you that.
Yeah. I mean, it's not a perfect plan. There's still politics involved in it. The governor appoints the members of that commission, but I agree completely. It's so much better than elections, and I think it's better than just some situation where just the governor would appoint. I mean, that's what we have in the federal one, and it's not. And I certainly would favor that over elections.
So speaking of money and politics, what do you make over the fact that Governor Greitens has established a nonprofit to raise money? Which you can use for whatever purposes I guess he finds suitable, and bypassing Amendment 2, which was passed overwhelmingly by the Missouri electorate last year.
Yeah, well, I mean, this relates really to the previous question. I mean, so you could have a similar group to raise millions of dollars for a particular judge on the Supreme Court if you had elections instead of the Missouri Plan. We still don't know, at least as far as I've seen. We still don't know who it was who gave the $2 million to Greitens during the election campaign. You know, what they do is they set up these 501c4 nonprofit corporations that don't have to report their donors. Their donors can turn out to be, as it did in the Greitens case, some organization that no one's ever heard of and about which there is no information. So, I think this idea of dark money, which is the term that people use, is, I mean, it's very damaging to a democracy. The Greitens people say, you know, the Greitens supporters say, hey, you know, it's only – people only really care about – nobody's really complaining about this around kitchen tables. Yeah. They care about kitchen table issues, and they don't care about this. You know, the people of Missouri voted for Amendment 2.
It was 70%, wasn't it?
So I think maybe they do care.
Yeah. Well, one interesting aspect of this, it's kind of peripheral, is the fact that reporters would like to ask the governor about this, but he's not taking many questions these days.
You know, he's an unusual guy. You know, he said he had one press conference, but he's like run away from various announcements and refused to take answers to questions. Meanwhile, you know, the sort of biased national news like Fox News is obviously trying to groom him as one of the you know, a national darling kind
they,
of.
They profiled him on a Sunday morning, as the rising star.
Chris Wallace, profiled him as a rising star. So we're going to see a lot more of Greitens.
Now, in Greitens' defense, and I'm not really defending him, but he's not the only one doing this. Right. It's being done by both parties throughout the country, and Citizens United, that case that we've talked about before, has kind of helped open the door for this. So we're getting more money being hidden, and I've never felt completely comfortable about that you can cut off money because it's like water, it flows, but you should know where that money's coming from to know about the connections. I also don't think we don't know who paid for his inauguration, do we?
No.
I don't think so. No. Yeah. No. And, you know,
nor his plane.
The mystery plane, right? Yeah.
Citizens United is partly responsible for this situation. But, you know, Citizens United did not rule out disclosure. The Congress could require disclosure of these contributions, but it refuses to do so. And that is the Republican Party that's doing that.
Sydney, on the press access issue, I've heard people compare the governor with Donald Trump and the fact that he's pulling back, which the president has done. He is reaching the American public via tweet now, and he is limiting access to pool reporters in conditions where he's meeting with foreign dignitaries, for instance. Do you see a similarity there?
It certainly seems to be the trend in politics these days, direct access to folks through social media.
Yeah.
And I think that raises an important issue of the role of the press, the role of the press as being curator, as helping us understand the news, put it in perspective, and also the difference between an on-time tweet and a chance to kind of think about and analyze what's happening.
Well, something that's just scary as heck is when you try to get behind Donald Trump's tweet relating to the supposed Obama wiretapping, and it comes down to these reports in disreputable news organizations or by disreputable commentators like Mark Levin or Judge Napolitano on Fox News. And that's what he is basing his information on when he can pick up the phone and he can call up the FBI director or the attorney general or the director of national security and get the answers. I mean, he's president now. He doesn't have to rely on unreliable news organizations, if you even call them news organizations, to get his information and make this decision. So what are foreign governments like Germany and Britain going to think when Trump tells them something in a national crisis? Are they going to believe him, given this track record? I think he's doing terrible damage to his credibility.
I wonder, you know, there certainly is criticism of the president, and he certainly has people who are on his side. There's no question about it. But every once in a while, you hear someone say, I wonder if he is approaching or has approached the area of impeachable offense. Do you see, I mean, is there any grounds yet for anything like that?
I don't think we're there yet.
I mean, I think you could impeach him if you wanted to, but the Republicans in Congress are not going to do it. Impeachment's a political I mean, yeah, you got to have some reasons, but it's a political move. It's not a legal move. And the Republicans are not there.
I mean, if all this smoke that surrounds the connections between the Trump campaign and the Russians who did the hacking of the emails, if that turns into fire, then there would be, you know, potentially an impeachable offense if it goes up, you know, to Trump. But yeah, I mean, there are certainly the ranking Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee sort of laid out the timetable of interactions between the Russians and Trump officials from the sort of Republican convention through the election, where you have Roger Stone saying that he had contact with is it called Guccifer, who is the source of the hacked emails from the Russians. So you know, we know that there are these connections and that parts of the Republican platform relating to Ukraine were changed, apparently, based upon, Trump assistants who had been in contact with Russian officials about those changes. So there's quite a bit there, and we'll see whether it all sort of bursts into flame or just dissipates.
Right. Any other thoughts on
that? It's a lot to have, though, in the first – what are we in, week four? I don't even know. I mean,
maybe
it's
six.
It's kind of incredible, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's move on. Let's come back to Missouri here with regard to what the legislature is up to. It's moving on workplace discrimination issues. What's going on there? Mark, are you up to speed on that?
Yeah, they're just trying to change the law to say that discrimination has to be the controlling factor, not just a factor. And so when you're trying to prove discrimination, you know, nobody ever says, I am firing you because you're African-American. I'm firing you because you're a woman. They'll offer other reasons. And then you're trying to find – the plaintiff's trying to find that smoking gun where they said something to someone. But if you also have then a poor – attendance record or a bad review, they can say, well, yeah, that might have been the case, but we've also got this other reason. So you can't show that that was the controlling reason. So it's just going to make it much more difficult to prove discrimination in Missouri. Now, it does bring us more in line with what the federal courts have done with the federal laws. And we have federal laws and we have state laws. Mm-hmm. We have the EEOC, we have the Missouri Commission on Human Rights, which all look at discrimination issues.
But I think this bill, which I guess will soon will be law, I believe it was onto the House, unless the House did it today. Yeah. I think it goes even beyond where federal law goes in requiring the discrimination to be the but-for reason for the firing or the demotion, and that's a place where the federal law doesn't go. It also has other provisions such as making it harder for whistleblowers to defend themselves. I think I've mentioned before this is known in the legislature as the enterprise portion of the bill. They once lost a lawsuit to one, a whistleblower who complained about their accounting procedures, and so they've been intent upon changing that part of the bill ever since. But you know, it's whistleblowers need to be protected if they're going to come out and blow the whistle on things that could be unsafe for the people.
Yeah, I want to side with Bill on this one, that I think this House bill is going to make it much harder to prove discrimination under state law than under federal law. This takes us to a much tougher stand.
And more favorable, therefore, to employers.
Yes.
Right.
So it goes along with a lot of the other things that have been passed. You know, there's also a bill that has been passed to make it harder to have, change the sort of standards for expert testimony to set the standards higher. Of course, there's right to work. Yeah. That's already passed.
How about minimum wage, which is all, which is also wage. Something that's current and they're mulling over.
Right.
Richard, the Senate Pro Tem, and saying why we needed to get rid of the Missouri plan was one of his complaints was the Missouri Supreme Court decision on the minimum wage. You know, the Missouri Supreme Court saying that St. Louis's minimum wage didn't conflict with state law. But, you know, that was I believe it was a unanimous decision of the Missouri Supreme Court. It was pretty straightforward. Pretty straightforward law. And you know, the legislature is now going to, I guess, pass a law to try to overturn that decision.
But just to be clear, that the legislature is looking at precluding municipalities from increasing the minimum wage beyond the state minimum wage.
Right.
Right. That is in the pipeline yeah. right now.
Oh. Did we talk about right to work last time?
Yes.
We did?
Okay. Yes. I think it had just – okay, it had passed good. Like 5 minutes after the legislature.
Okay, yeah, really.
So, yeah, we talked about it last time. Something else we've talked about before, but there's kind of a new twist on this, and that is concerns the American Civil Liberties Union has filed suit on behalf of the state public defenders who are consistently complaining about being underfunded. And the ACLU is saying, in fact, that is the case, and that therefore clients are not getting the kind of representation that that they deserve. What does the ACLU want? I mean, is it just basically asking the state, committing the state to more money?
Yeah, more funding for more attorneys. I think they said something like they want 300 more or something. I may be wrong.
Well, they got to pay for them, though.
Yeah, well, the state would have to allocate the funds and – just like there are certain things you have, you have a constitutional right, and you can't bypass that. So this is brought by the ACLU, by that MacArthur Foundation, whatever that group here in St. Louis. It's May. What's May's last name?
May Quinn.
And then, but there was also a San Francisco Oreck law firm. I mean, it's a big time law firm. So. I don't think this is going to go away easily.
I mean, Missouri ranks 49th out of 50 in the last survey I saw on the amount of money that they provide for public defenders. There seem to be, you know, various examples given in the litigation of you know, public defenders just not having time to get to defendants and get and do the kind of pretrial research they need to do. To be able to defend them.
And people staying in jail until they get to talk to their lawyer, just sitting there.
Yeah, and this is a problem that's been building over time and getting worse and worse and has hit crisis proportions.
But the state doesn't have any money. I mean, the state's looking for ways to save money. It can be compelled by the court to come up with the cash to fund this particular office.
Yes.
Yes, yes. That's the way constitutional rights work. You have to honor them. You're supposed to honor them.
So the money, if it happens, would have to be taken from someplace else.
Right. Or from additional revenue.
Or additional revenue,
Taxes. Increased taxes, perhaps.
Taxes or fees. There are various ways you might fund a public defender office.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Anything else to add to that? Let's move on to the question of the bathroom issue affecting the transgender community in several states. The Supreme Court punted on that bill. It basically decided it would not decide.
Yeah, and they did that, I think, partly because, well, they may have been divided 4-4, but also because the Trump administration changed the guidance under Title IX. Title IX is the law, you know, we always think about in terms of women's athletics, but it's, you know, anti-discrimination, anti-sex discrimination in public universities. And so the Obama administration had said that that to deny a transgender person the bathroom of his or her sexual identity was sex discrimination in violation of Title IX. The Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals in Richmond had said, well, we're going to defer to the Obama administration's interpretation of the law. Then the Trump administration withdrew the Obama administration's interpretation of the law. So the Supreme Court said, hey, we're sending it back to the Court of Appeals. We'll figure it out.
Yeah, you figure it out.
Once again, the Missouri legislature also working on this particular issue.
A number of states, yeah. So yeah. This is my political views, but it's just very unfortunate that this is what we're doing as a state and forcing people into you know, somebody who identifies as a woman telling them, no, you're going to have to go somewhere else. And I just think it's too bad.
One of the decisions that Gorsuch was involved in upheld a corporation that denied a transgender person a bathroom of his or her choice and based upon public some sort of safety concern. So I'm sure he'll probably be asked about that case as time goes on.
And you know, we have state laws going both ways. We have 14 states that provide state
That's
law
true.
Protections, and then we have other states that
right.
prohibit protections. And then we have states that are in the middle. And what we're going to be watching this particular case now at the circuit court level is we'll have a court decision on what Title IX says without the guidance from the administration as to what they believe the correct reading of Title IX is. So it'll be an interesting case to watch.
There is an aspect to this that doesn't get much discussion except from people in the transgender community, and that is that this is a safety issue. Because if they are forced into a specific restroom, they are therefore singled out and potentially targeted by bullies, which you don't hear too much about with regard to that aspect of this.
Right. I mean, to her credit, the new education secretary did say, even while they were withdrawing this Obama guidance, did say this doesn't mean that we still are going to be very vigilant about bullying. We'll see.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All righty. Let's take one more topic before we have to say goodbye, and that is the another Supreme Court decision that is an interesting one, that verdicts can be challenged if there is evidence surfacing of racism in jury deliberations. Where did that come from?
Well, so this was a case where during jury deliberations, one of the jurors, I think a former police officer, said some disparaging things about the Hispanic man and his witness. He was alleged of fondling some girls.
A former police officer who was on the jury.
And so typically, you don't go into what happens in the jury room. It's just a mystery. But the court said, because we've got such a history of racial animus playing a bad role in judicial decisions, we're going to make an exception for this. And if there was allegations of racial bias, then we're going to look at it.
So what this juror said was, I think he did it because he's a Mexican, and Mexican men take whatever they want. In other words, take from women whatever they want. So pretty about as overt, you know, this is why he is guilty, because he is Mexican.
But someone on the jury panel is going to have to blow the whistle on
they
this,
did.
Obviously.
And that's what the Supreme Court judges who dissented are worried about. They said, look, we don't agree with this, but we're worried that now everyone's going to start talking to jurors afterwards. It'll make jury service even less attractive than it already is. And that's the bad that was their concern.
Yeah. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.